Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh yeah, hey, this is Carol Jurgensen Sheets. Happy holidays to you. I'm Carol the Coach, and I am here talking to you tonight about sexual addiction. And you know, as Russell just indicated, he had a lot of what we call collateral indicators for that illness. And it's kind of interesting because my basic question to both men and women is, why do you think you're a sex addict? And most of them say things like, well, you know, I've experienced a lot of trauma as a child, or wow, I came from a rigid and disengaged family. And they said they didn't get their needs met and figured out that by distracting themselves, by self-soothing with sex, by redirecting their pain, they got into a compulsive behavior that ended up really backfiring on them. And when you create that compulsive behavior, what ends up happening is that can become predisposed to sexual addiction. And that means that you have to heal the wounds or improve that sense of intimacy in your own relationships currently if you stand a chance of getting healthy. And that's what this show's all about. I interview experts all over the world on what they can do to get healthy and make their lives better and then take their life to the next level. And so we've got an exciting year in 2016. I'm going to be interviewing a lot of people who really know their stuff, have done research in the field, are shame experts. And boy, I can't tell you, when you listen to the experts, it helps you to really feel better about your own situation. You get an understanding. And when you find understanding, information is power. And then when I talk to you about the resources out there that are available to you, whether it's books or clinics or workshops or intensives, you know, there's something called an intensive outpatient program. And in the world of sexual addiction, it typically means 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days of treatment. And then if you have to do residential treatment, that usually means 30 to 45 days of intensive treatment. I know I was talking to a young man a couple of days ago, and I said to him, our therapy is going to help, but it's not going to be enough. And, you know, I've worked with a couple of thousand sex addicts clinically, and I have probably only made the referral to go inpatient or residential treatment maybe a handful of, two handfuls of times. And I said, you're somebody that isn't probably going to get better until you get some intensive work. Now, if I had my druthers, I would have everybody get to get away and really focus on themselves for 30 to 45 days. And, you know, with any addiction, the more intensive work you do on yourself, the faster you heal. He, of course, said, I don't want to spend the money. And I said to him, you know what? I've got bad teeth. I was born with bad teeth. I mean, I had braces, and by the time I was 14 and those braces were off, they actually told me that I needed over 230 fillings. They couldn't tell. Anybody who looked at me said, oh, you got beautiful teeth. But I mean, I have a condition, and it causes bad teeth. And so by the time I was 50, I had to have implants. And I had 7 implants put into my mouth. And those implants cost me $18,000 and insurance didn't pay. Now, I didn't want to spend that money on my mouth. And I fought it for a little while, maybe about 6 months, kind of arguing, oh, do I really have to do it? I'll just keep having the dental work done. I go to the dentist like 3 times a year. I do all the preventive. Then I realized, you know what? You need to do what's going to work long term and be in your best interest. So now I joke. I got a used car in my mouth. And these implants have been fabulous. You know, I no longer have to worry about dental decay on those teeth. And yes, it was a lot of money, and it was worth every penny. And if I had an addiction, and I was really struggling, and I was relapsing or slipping all the time, and those 10 recovery tools weren't working, maybe because I couldn't get my life together enough to do the 10 recovery tools, I would go into intensive treatment and get the job done. I mean, it's not a magic wand. I'm not here to tell you, oh, yeah, if you go into treatment, you'll no longer have a sex addiction. You always have a sex addiction. Being in recovery and really understanding yourself and doing the hard work pays off. That's what I promise. So that's why places like Elements and The Ranch and Keystone and Capstone and Meadows, they're all incredible. They're incredible facilities that really help you to gain a hold on the work that you need to do. I cannot recommend it enough. So I would highly recommend that you do it. And again, I have to tell you that clearly, when you invest in yourself, when you do the hard work, it pays off. And that's what I promise you, your whole life. Now tonight, we are going to be talking with a woman, and she is, well, she's doing the thing that I would love to do. I have been so enamored with Brené Brown's work on shame. And I got to tell you, Stacey Corfist has been certified to do shame work, has been certified to do Brené Brown's work. And I asked her if she could come on and talk about that. And there was some sort of glitch in that, you know, she's not really supposed to represent the work via the media. I kind of get that. If she had something wrong, which Stacey won't, she's an expert in the field, they don't want anybody misrepresenting the work. So Stacey has done a great job of learning and treating shame. And so she's going to be talking about, you know, what is sexual addiction recovery work, and how do you work with shame within that work? Because it is such an instrumental part of, it's a byproduct of sexual addiction. You've heard me say it before. I bet you could repeat it right now without me going any further. It is the addict that carries the shame and the partner that carries the pain. And we're going to talk with Stacy about, are there shortcuts to shame work, and, you know, what are her common themes? Because this woman runs workshops, and she just does a great job of working with clients through her practice. Website is www.branchescenter.com, and she really has made it life's mission to help people recovery. If they have eating disorders, work on that. Deal with sexual addiction and love avoidance. And so I feel absolutely thrilled that she is willing to come in and talk to us the week after Christmas. You know, this is a week that a lot of people really work diligently on relaxing. So I really admire that about her. And, you know, Branches offers a lot of outpatient counseling and educational services for children and adolescents, adults and families. And she uses an integrative approach to treatment. That's why she's so good at what she does. The workshop curriculum that she uses through Dr. Brené Brown is developed to help men, women, and adolescents learn how to show up, be seen, and live braver lives. Live brave. That is Brené Brown's signature statement. So can't wait to talk with her and find out more about that. And you know, I almost always, invariably, share with you a little history on people that I've worked with, and whether they be clinicians or therapists. I mean, they just do a great job of maximizing, if you will, knowledge they have and take it to the next level for my listening audience. And you know, I know that majority of listeners are either addicts or their partners, and they're wanting to understand this disorder more. So that's what this show is about. It's about explaining what works and what doesn't, and how to get healthy. And unfortunately, there is a lot of shame. I'm talking about sexual addiction, but this situation is exploding. Got into this field because I was getting a lot of calls about kids that had compulsive sexual behavior. And teachers and administrators and counselors did not know what to do. And so I feel so fortunate to be able to help them, having been certified by ITAP, which is the Institute for International Addictions. And what we know about sex addiction is that there is typically multiple addictions. So, you know, maybe you have an eating disorder and you have a sexual addiction. Maybe you're sexually anorexic and you have an eating disorder. Maybe you are an overspender or you have a gambling addiction. Perhaps you're a workaholic. There's addictive behavior that shows up in lots of different ways. And I'm just so thankful that we have this show to disseminate information and make you feel better about it. You know, you can always email me at carolthecoach@aol.com, or you can go to my website, which is www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach. And I will always do my best to get you to the right places. You know, I typically don't say this, but I do Skype and phone coaching for a fee, you know, to get you the right resources, because what we know as CSATs is that there are not enough available counselors yet, but I promise there will be if you just hang in there, to offer you the specialized training that you deserve. And so if you are wanting help, what you can do is go to sexhelp.com put in your zip code, and find out who is certified and trained in your area who can help you. So I just really admire the fact that, you know, clearly people that are certified have spent a lot of money, providers of services that they can be. So, Stacy, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you, Carol.
Oh, I'm so pleased that you were willing to do this, because I was telling my listening audience earlier that clearly you have gotten some incredible training from being a CEO to also and doing the Brené Brown work, and made it your mission to learn the most you possibly can about shame and shame reduction and recovery from shame. So tell me a little bit about what directed you into that path.
Well, you're right. And I think paths find us sometimes, you know, if we get out of our own way. And the thing I like about the Brené Brown work with shame resilience in particular is that the trainings that I like are the trainings that make us do our own work. I never want to ask someone to do something that I haven't yet attempted and addressed myself. And so what I like about shame, first of all, it's universal. Anyone that says they don't have it is lying. Is that we all have it. It's universal. And so, you know, it's kind of, you're right. I only caught the tail end of your intro about, you know, the amount of money that we spend in our trainings and such. It's really, you know, a perk, because we get to do our own work as well. And so the thing I like about the shame work is, you know, you can never get enough of that for yourself.
Oh, I 100% agree. So, you said this work kind of found you, and how is this work different from other clinical types of work, let's say from PM Melody or from our CSAT training or whatever?
Yeah, you know, because I've done several. I've done PM Melody's, you know, codependency model. I've done that. I've done sensory motor work, Pat Ogden's work. I've worked with Dan Siegel, his interpersonal neurobiology. I guess what I'd have to say, that's a tough question to answer so simplistically, is that it provides a language, a universal language to use. I think that this work integrates very, very well in the addiction culture and the CSAT culture. So those struggling with sex addiction, partners of sex addiction trauma, I think this model provides a language, because it really unfolds shame. People can you can hear about shame. There's a lot of work on resilience and happiness, positive psychology now. But what I like about this model is it actually provides a deeper language to use, because sometimes we overuse, as you know, the word codependency. So the difference between this model and some of the others is it really unwraps that vocabulary and language.
Got it. And now, how do you integrate this kind of work with the 12 steps and sexual addiction recovery work?
Yeah, so, you know, there's several, you know, there's several books and information out there on shame. The work that I've been involved in most recently is Brené Brown's work. Most people have heard her TED Talks and have read her books, et cetera. And first of all, you know, Brené comes from an addiction clinical field, so she's worked in the field. It works very, very well, because if you think about shame and vulnerability and you think about what shame does, it actually disconnects. We want to disconnect and hide when we're feeling shame. And if you think about the 12 steps and you think about what that's all about, you know, think about the logo of 12 steps, integration, connection. So Brené's work and the shame resilience work is about connection. It is about being vulnerable. And it integrates with the 12-step model superbly, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most of the clients that have done the work. With the sex addiction recovery, again, if they're going through the work with the 12 steps, I just mentioned about that. But if they're not, if it's sex addiction clients and partners and spouses working through sex addiction, it also fits very well because, again, remember there's a language to use. It's not just this theme. There's a language. It's really unwrapping how it works, and the if it's a couple going through sex addiction recovery, you know, they can provide a language and they can understand their shame triggers in themselves and in each other. So it's been very, very exciting.
Absolutely. Now, I'm sure that you use this work both in individual and in group therapy. Can you give us a little example of how you use it in both types of settings?
Sure. I think it works well in both. I'm always an advocate of the group work. Sometimes people are ready to really unwrap this on an individual basis. In doing this model and in working with shame, resilience, I'll get to it in a minute, what and all it entails, but working with it individually really involves recognizing what are your shame triggers, how do you experience that in yourself, and maybe in a minute I can back up and explain like how I introduce this to people, especially people in recovery, sex addiction recovery, etc., to really get them to understand, you know, why and how this model works. But individually, it might be to understand their shame triggers, how they experience shame in their bodies. First of all, they might not be ready for the group work because of the amount of trauma that's surfacing. If it's a partner just post-discovery, they might not really be resourced enough, so they might need to do that work individually and really understand and wrap themselves around their shame triggers, how to resource those triggers, how to recognize what that is, what's the difference between shame and guilt, et cetera. So that's a little bit individual. I know I'm sort of jumping ahead, but the group work is just phenomenal because remember, especially in the 12-step work, it's really about honesty, integrity, connection, speaking up. What I'd have to say with the group work, and I'm sure many people on the call or listening can really understand, and I see this all the time, is group work is phenomenal. But when you're talking about sex addiction and you're talking about, let's just say, the sex addict who is in recovery, early in recovery, doing their group work, it's so important to be amongst people that understand, because in this shame work, there's this concept of fitting in and belonging. And if you're just going to an AA meeting, doing your work, but you're really not disclosing your quote secrets, you're just fitting in, you're not belonging, and that's not shame resiliency work. The same goes true for the partners in group work as well. It's really, really important when you do this kind of work to go to a group where you can belong, take risks, be vulnerable, and belong and not just fit in. Because if you're just fitting in and not sharing and not opening up or not feeling like your problem is on the same level as theirs, you're already putting yourself in a one-down position, and it's really not helpful. So the work can be phenomenal, but it's really important to find a safe group to do this work with. Sorry for that long answer.
Yeah, because obviously just by being a part of the group, you have reduced some of the shame because there are people there that feel the same way, so you're not alone, or have gotten past some of the shame, so it gives you hope, strength, and recovery. I agree. Groups are so powerful. And, you know, a lot of people go, oh, work, there's a lot of work in groups. But I actually believe that there's less work for me in groups because there's so much positive feedback that's given in groups that has nothing to do with me.
The wonderful thing is you can do your work vicariously through others and groups. Somebody might be sharing. It might not be the exact piece that matches you, but they're sharing that deeper somatic experience that you can heal through listening and giving feedback in. And so the interesting thing about group or treatment for those that have to go inpatient or higher level of care or do workshops, intensities, et cetera, is that, you know, shame starts at the very beginning, right at the start of recovery. When I also treat eating disorders, so a lot of times the talk and the chatter is, I'll go to that recovery, I'll go to that and get that treatment, but I'm going to lose 10 pounds first, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an addict, I'll go into treatment, but when? And for sex addiction, it might be, you know, I'm going to open up and be vulnerable. I'll show up in recovery, but I'm really not going to unfold these secrets until I'm certain that my wife's not going to leave me or my spouse isn't going to leave me. So this whole idea of shame, and it's really about vulnerability, really starts right from the start.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Now, you had talked about, you didn't call it shame reduction. Did you call it shame resilience?
Resilience.
Yeah, that's a new term. Can you explain to our listening audience what is it? Almost seems like an oxymoron, shame and resilience.
Yeah, because it's really a revolution. It's really, we are, you know, really making a movement here. And it's really not about taking shame away. It's a revolution of resilience. It's a revolution of, you know, sort of owning our feelings, not avoiding them. And so shame resilience is actually a practice. It's a practice. It's a verb, kind of like love is a verb. Shame resilience is a verb, and it's a verb and a practice of recognizing your triggers, knowing what's going on. In a minute, I can talk about like knowing if it's shame, if it's guilt, what's going on, how to recognize it in the body, how to care for yourself, how to set boundaries for yourself. So again, doesn't this all sound really similar to the 12-step practice? It can be a spirituality of such. So shame resiliency is really about a practice, and a very informed, purposeful practice.
Okay, so give me an example of working with somebody towards shame resilience and how you would know if he or she were making progress.
Okay. Oh, let me think for a second and try to apply it. Well, I have an example that's come up recently, and let me think if that's a good one or not. Shame resiliency, and it might be, well, here we go. The holidays just came, okay? So practicing shame resiliency in a family system over the holidays, I'm sure lots of people can relate to that. I feel like I'm 12 years old the minute I step foot in my family again, you know. And in a minute, if I don't recognize, you know, those triggers going on in me, I'll be my 15-year-old self all over again. So someone in recovery might recognize when they're practicing shame resilience, when instead of going into old communication dynamics, instead of going along with Uncle Joe, who's mocking and putting, let's just say, heavy people on TV down, instead of sort of mocking people like that, and instead of joining in, because that might have been what you did to sort of be safe so you're not next on the chopping block, you might sort of join in that. So shame resiliency skills in recovery are when you're recognizing, I don't like that feeling I'm getting. What's going on? I know what's going on because I recognize this feeling. I don't know what's going on with Uncle Joe right now. Something is. But first of all, I'm recognizing this pit in my stomach, and I'm recognizing, like, yuck, I'm shrinking. I'm getting warm. I have a lump in my throat. And then it's paying attention to that cue, saying, aha, I know that people putting down body image is a trigger for me. That's what's going on there. So you know what? I don't have this all under control yet, but I know I'm going to excuse myself from Uncle Joe. I'm not going to make a scene, but I'm just going to walk into the other room. Or I might say something. So there's lots of ways you can practice that. But practicing shame resiliency is recognizing what's going on for yourself and setting boundaries for yourself so you're not re-traumatized. And then in the end, you feel really good about it. It might not work out perfectly. You know, you might not be able to speak up to Uncle Joe, but you might be able to leave the room and recognize, wow, you know, that's something I've never done before. And so that's just an example. And you know, we practice these things a gazillion times a day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So then, obviously, that's a great example of shame resilience because you don't end up having to engage or join in when you don't agree, and you remove your situation, yourself from the situation, and therefore you detach from it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's basically four elements to the shame resiliency work, and I'll go through them briefly, and then the first one is, like I said, recognizing shame and shame triggers. Okay, so I kind of talked about that. I'll go through them all four, and then I'll kind of dice them up. Recognizing shame and shame triggers. Practicing critical awareness to shame and shame resilience. Reaching out and telling our story and having a life with values and integrity. And speaking about shame by asking and sharing and connecting. So, you know, that's really vague, but those are the four elements of shame resilience work. Okay. So the first one, you want me to just keep going a little bit?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the first one is recognizing shame and shame triggers. Well, I already gave you a little bit of an intro on that, and that is asking yourselves, what is shame for me? How do I define shame? You know, there is a definition of shame, which is, well, I'll give you John Bradshaw. I love, you know, years and years ago, I love what he always says about shame and embarrassment. And he calls it, that's why they call it embarrassment, because you're caught with your pants down, embarrassment. And I get a kick out of that all the time. but Brene Brown's definition of shame is that intense, you know, painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and unworthy of even belonging, and that somehow we feel like we're just a mess and bad, and the focus is on the self, not the behavior. And so it never leads us towards a positive experience. So Brene Brown has a little bit of a differing sort of viewpoint on shame. And I think this is important when you work with anybody, the therapist, the coach, the colleague, the spouse, on understanding sort of what vocabulary and definition of shame you're using. Because a lot of people talk about shame, but what they're really doing is they're really talking about guilt. Guilt is I've done bad. Shame is I am bad. And so according to Brene, you know, I can't think of anything good that would ever come from I am bad. And so it's really important to understand that and turn it into, you know, I did something bad. That's my behavior, not me. And so there's a little bit of a difference going on, like you said, with some of these other, some of the other information out in the field. And so it's really important to understand, you know, what definition you're using. And so recognizing shame and how that is in your body, and kind of a, I'll call it fun, shame work fun,
right?
Assignment to do is to draw like a, not a stick figure, but like a gingerbread man on a piece of paper and draw how you experience shame in your body, because everybody does it differently, but there are some universals, you know, just a warm wash all over you, shrinking, your throat getting choked up. So the first resilience piece about recognizing shame is recognizing how you feel it in your body. I'm guessing you do a lot of work on the trauma pieces, you know, in some of your shows. And so there's so much out there about the somatic part. So we can talk about shame, and that's critical, and maybe I can talk about that in a second, but also how we experience it in our bodies, because sometimes our bodies are telling us stuff that we are not ready to, like, listen to. So time slows down, chest gets really tight, hot, your throat gets all choked up. So everybody's got different shame triggers. So I think that that's really, really important to understand, because back to our Uncle Joe exercise, you know, or example, you know, Uncle Joe's just going on criticizing people, putting people down. You're not really sure what's going on. So in the past, you might just sort of like be lost in that, you know, dissociative even throughout that. But now you've recognized your shame triggers in your body somatically. So now you know, you know, when I feel this lump in my throat, or when I just feel lightheaded all of a sudden, I better pay attention to that. And so that right there with the shame resiliency work, that's like a huge piece of understanding and having your own definition of how you experience shame. And it changes, of course, you know. And then to practice critical awareness about that. Practice critical awareness. What are the ways you defend from shame, you know? How, nobody wants to feel that. Who wants to feel shame? It's very uncomfortable. Be very, very aware of how you defend against that. And doing the work, oftentimes it's broken down into three ways, really. And the first one might be moving away. We become very small, quiet, isolate, disappear, show up late to our therapy appointments, avoid, no show, all of those things. So some people cope with shame by doing those things. Others get angry, criticized, like Uncle Joe. Aggression, put downs, personal attacks. It's all over our politics, you know. We want to disgrace a female politician. But because we don't believe her political opinions, we're going to criticize her pantsuit. So this kind of stuff is all over, you know, our society. And then, so that's moving against. And the third way that we defend ourselves inappropriately is moving towards, and those are the people pleasers, the sucker uppers, the perfectionists, you know. And so as part of this critical awareness within ourselves, it's really important to understand the ways we armor up against it, so that we can recognize that as well. And it sounds a lot like our family systems, if you think about it. So a lot of this work is really looking developmentally down the line, which, you know, we all know, but how did we learn those defenses? You know, if we learned with our Uncle Joe example, we learned to be quiet and laugh and please, and that would be moving towards, joke along with Uncle Joe, you know, and now we've got that as an example. Ooh, when I align, you know, with those people putting down heavy people, et cetera, I know that that is a defense that I'm using against shame. And so that's really important critical work to do in recognizing it. But I want to back up just a minute to talk about shame, because remember I said it's really about dissecting it and really breaking it down. And it's not just talking about this warm wash of a feeling. It's really, like I said, shame, I am bad, and the focus is on ourselves. Guilt, I did bad, and the focus is on others. Well, we've got a couple other things, too, which are really important. One is humiliation. Humiliation is when somebody disgraced you, maybe put you down. But the difference is for that, you know, you didn't deserve it. You're like, hey, I didn't deserve the way you're talking to me like that, you know. And then the next one is embarrassment. And embarrassment is this sense of universal sense. Like, who hasn't walked out of the bathroom with toilet paper? Who hasn't gone through an event, come home to find a big, huge hunk of broccoli in your teeth, you know? And so those are sort of fleeting, universal experiences. And so by using this language of what shame guilt is, you know, we can really break it down a little bit more and be objective about it. Because as trauma work, I don't know if we have time to get into that, as with trauma work, the naming it to taming it is absolutely important with shame work as well, because it's developmental in many ways to trauma. And so to name it, to tame it, is using your cognitive facets of your brain to sort of slow down that amygdala, slow down that trauma response. And so by slowing this down, saying, wait, is this shame? Is it guilt? No, this happens to others. You know, you can really, really get into that window of tolerance to process some of those more difficult, shameful moments.
Well, you know, I know that so many of our listeners have experienced a lot of shame as a result of trauma. And then obviously as they reenact that trauma in their own way, then they feel even more shame. It's just layers upon layers upon layers of shame. So I would love to hear what your definition is of trauma and how you see that playing itself out in sexual addiction.
Ooh, okay, that's a doozy. Trauma, you know, I really like Pia's, I won't get it perfectly, you know, anything less than nurturing is traumatic. Now, I will talk about that in reference to shame work, because one of the armors that we use for vulnerability, because we armor up against vulnerability. We don't want to feel vulnerable. We armor up. One of the ways we do that is perfectionism. That's a biggie. But another biggie is comparing suffering, you see. And so there is this whole concept of big T's and little T's, et cetera. And you know, I definitely support all of that. But in reference to how sort of traumas sort of interact with this work, is it's really important, again, with the group. It's so common for somebody to say, oh, well, I didn't have that going on, so I don't have a right to speak up, you know. So I think with this work, it's anything less than nurturing is trauma. Now, again, there's always the big T, little T, and some of that deeper work. But as long as we are comparing our suffering to others and making ours less than, we're in shame. And so it's really, really important. That's why I like group work, because those things and those comments pop up, you know. We want to compare all the time, especially when we don't have the big T traumas and we're minimizing our little T traumas of abandonment, avoidance, etc. And so it's super, super important, again, to really back it up with that first phase of recognizing shame and vulnerability and how we armor up against it. So a lot of times we don't even recognize trauma until we start opening up this work. We think we had a very nice, you know, oh, I had a good family, everything was good. You know, we hear that all the time. Until we sort of start breaking this down, and then all of a sudden you've got that warm wash of shame when you realize, I didn't have a perfect childhood. It was less than perfect. I didn't get my needs met. And that, again, can bring on these waves of emotion, and that trauma has to be weaved and integrated into the work.
Yeah, and you know, interestingly enough, you had described earlier that trauma is about feeling bad, not guilty, not that you've done something wrong or that you've done something bad, but that you are bad. And what we know about sex addicts is that many of them were traumatized as kids. Either they were emotionally, physically, verbally, sexually abused, and they have such shame around that that it almost creates a compulsivity that then they reenact as they get older. And so obviously you were talking about shame resiliency earlier, but my experience is when a client figures that out, that they have reenacted that, possibly even to feel some control and power
mm-hmm.
over a situation that they absolutely had none as a child, they're less harsh on themselves. They're able to accept that
connect.
They didn't know any better. And, of course, then they work on that progress, not perfection thing, and that coupled with a great fellowship really allows them an opportunity to make changes that are healthy and to give back and to depend on something other than themselves to make changes. And so it all is interwoven. And don't you find that at least 33-40% of your sexual addiction population has had serious trauma as a kid? Not little T trauma, big T trauma.
I would. I would agree with that. And I would throw a wrench into this. It's not really a wrench. It's like a road bump into
okay.
what you're just saying, because you described, I do a lot of work with couples. A lot of my work with sex addiction is treating the couple. And
uh-huh.
so what I find a lot of, and again, this is where the shame work and using this language and understanding all of this process comes in, because what you just described, let's just say with sex addiction, is the addict unleashing, unlocking shame, really wrapping themselves around resiliency, giving themselves the compassion they need, that they aren't their behaviors, reaching out and support. So what you talked about is actually connection. So when you release shame, you start to connect with others. And it feels really good, you know, tears, and you can, you know, because to feel like you belong and you're worthy again, feels really good, really empowering. And also what happens, the wrench is coming, get ready.
Okay.
So what happens is the secrecy is gone. So the thing about shame is it's about secrecy, silence, judgment, and cat's out of the bag and you're connecting now and it feels really, really good. Now I'm going to throw the wrench in, because what often happens all the time with couples, here's this partner now, here's a spouse or partner who wasn't aware of the secrecy, shame, and silence, and, you know, all of this sort of got blasted with discovery, right? So all of a sudden the partner feels like tag I'm it, and they feel sort of cheated, and they have this bomb on them where they're feeling like their spouse, and they're invested in their recovery, and their spouse is feeling really good about their work and themselves. They're feeling really good, while the partner is still in that highly traumatized place, not quite ready for group yet, not quite ready to expose the shame. And they're sort of feeling like, well, great, you feel great, now I feel like crap. And now I've got all these secrets, and where's there a group for me? Here you are sharing yourself, feeling really good, sponsor, et cetera. I'm not quite ready for all that yet, and I'm just suffering alone with this. And so by having this model to explain what's going on and explain it using terms, using also the trauma model of naming it, to tame it, et cetera, really, really, I think really helps quite a bit. And also can really kind of speed up that really uncomfortable phase that couples go through.
That is a great point. And you're right. It's almost universal that the addict feels that shame, that they're so hungry for that connection. And it does leave the wife, typically, sometimes the husband, depending on who the addict
mm-hmm.
is, looking and feeling like they've been betrayed again, because now not only has the partner betrayed them, but now the partner is getting healthy and they don't have the same resources to feel that same sense of inclusion and hopefulness.
Right. And so to have
yeah.
this model
yeah,
and also
point.
Also using, you know, the codependence model and the trauma model also, because what happens And then to open up with some of this hyperarousal, hypoarousal with trauma just so quickly. You know, we've got a couple different ways we deal with trauma and we deal with shame. And one is to be hyperaroused and panic attacks, anxiety, can't stop talking about it. Now, let me just speak on the partner from that betrayal trauma that happens. Okay. And by the way, the betrayal traumas, they happen in the brain the same way as a physical trauma would happen or a sexual trauma would happen. In the brain, it's the same. So in the brain, I don't think there's a big T, little T. It's trauma. And so there's different ways that people sort of respond to trauma. And one might be hyperarousal early after discovery, and one might be shut down hypoarousal, you see, and it might just be flat, numb, you know. And I hope I'm not losing my track a little bit here, but to get in that window of tolerance where recovery can happen is really important, I think, to use this model in alignment and integrative with the trauma model to really explain what's going on. Because, and remember, I think when we can understand what's happening and wrap our prefrontal cortex around maybe what's happening to our emotions, we can, you know, get what Dan Siegel calls that gabagoo in our brain. That part that can kind of calm down the amygdala by using our cognitive senses. So I can't emphasize enough about, you know, like the psychoeducation piece on all of this. And so when I explain this to the couples, what's going on, like they really get it. And I really think it saves me many, many appointments.
Well, good point. As well as, again, it gives everybody a little bit more hope because the partner understands why he or she is feeling so frustrated. And the addict feels better understood, too, because you know as well as I do that let's just say it's a male addict and he's feeling happy and like he's finally found a resource and he's going to get better. And the wife is even angrier at him for his recovery. And it's like, wait a minute, I'm doing everything right and you're more mad at me today than you were when you first found out. So,
and right,
point,
and I'll
point.
Insert there. That again, because I've already done, you know, the beginning pieces of this, this would be a time for the example you just shared would be to explain, now with what you just said, where the partner's getting even more angry, because I think you said the husband in this example is getting happy and peaceful, so it's making her more angry and maybe exploding or whatever, I would ask, does that sound like moving away, retreating? Does that sound like sucking up, moving toward? Or does that sound like a moving against, put down? And is that sort of a armoring up against shame? And you have to be really careful with that. But again, remember, because we use the language, they might not be so emotionally reactive. And so by using the language and providing these examples and these definitions can really help, because if you allow, you know, that partner to be hyper aroused and explosive towards the spouse, the partner's really not being aware that that's a maladaptive shame response, you know. So that's kind of how it all fits together. It's very, very helpful with couples.
Oh, I bet. Now, help me to understand, because obviously you really believe in groups and you provide individual therapy. I was looking at your workshop and your website, because you do a variety of workshops and lectures. So tell everybody a little bit about that and how they can find out more from your website.
Sure. It's branchescenter.com, branches like the tree, center.com. And I'm just getting ready to launch to, I haven't even loaded up the 2016 workshops, et cetera. So, you know, I'm getting ready to have their 2-day intensives with this work. So what's important in doing some of the shame resiliency workshops is that there is some resourcing. Remember, you need to be a little bit resourced to do some of this work. So there's a pre-screening that's necessary to do that, to make sure there's some support. Those tend to be 2-day workshops, usually on a Friday, Saturday, and I'm getting ready to load those up within the week. But another piece that I feel quite strongly about is the educational component. So I might do an hour and a half workshop or educational piece on just describing what I just described with you is, what is the shame resiliency stuff? What does it look like? You know, let me get my buy-in, you know. Or it might be a workshop on explaining the drama triangle. That's another lecture. It's a one-hour lecture. Because remember, I do believe in group, but I also believe, you know, I believe in, it's going to sound kind of corny, but I really believe in having a love affair with your brain, falling in love with the brain, you know, really understanding, naming to taming it. And so I really, really love doing, you know, a one-hour educational workshop on what is the drama triangle, what is shame resilience, et cetera, eating disorder, you know, recovery, et cetera. So that's, and then, of course, there's, you know, outpatient work, et cetera. But the group work, the workshops, and the educational pieces are sort of a love of mine.
Excellent. And so, again, they can go to branches.com and
branchescenter.com.
Look at what you have to offer. And your next workshop that you're going to be offering is what?
It's going to be in, I believe, the end of January. I don't have it with me, but if they log on in about a week, everything should be booted up. I also give a lot of public presentations, so those should get loaded up as well. Sometime in January, I don't recall when the date is.
Got it. Okay. So clearly they can go to your website in about a week and see exactly what it is that you're going to be providing. And Branches is located where?
Well, there's two locations. We're in Southern California. And there's one in the Temecula Valley area and one in Redondo Beach area. Redondo office is a little bit smaller. The larger center is in the Temecula area. And then anybody in treatment centers, you know, I do a lot of the lectures, et cetera, in treatment centers, et cetera. So Southern California.
All right. And as we begin to close, Stacey, is there anything else that you would like to add? Because I feel like we just got started and we had to end, but I really appreciate all the information you disseminated tonight. Anything else you want to add to our listeners who are addicts, partners, and some clinicians?
You know, I think I would just say you're right. First of all, thanks for that validation, is that, you know, I've got this like spread of pages that I wanted to talk about, but as you see, there's just so much to it. I would just say for everyone, clinicians, clients, partners, everyone, is just to continue to be curious, just continue to be open and curious, because I think as a field we are, I mean, the stuff that we're learning in the field is just incredible, and I really appreciate the positive psychology side of things and where we are in the field as far as practicing self-compassion. And I think what inspires me the most in doing my own work is Kristen Neff's self-compassion mantra that I just practice all the time. And you have to recognize when you're suffering. So that has to do with shame. And when you do recognize that you're suffering, is just to say Kristen Neff's mantra, and that's, this is a moment of suffering. And may I be gentle on myself right now. And may I use the tools to take care of myself, because suffering's universal. Suffering's a part of life. It happens. And I think by using that mantra, we're not trying to like hide shame and hide vulnerability, but we're able to recognize it and slowly walk through it and be resilient through it versus avoiding it, hiding it, sneaking around it. And so I would just say, you know, the practice of self-compassion and mindfulness is a biggie.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I know you gave our listeners a lot of hope, and I look forward to talking to you again soon in the future. Thanks, Stacey.
Thanks, Carol. Good night.
Good night. So there I was again talking to a very wise woman who has made it her mission to help people with self-compassion, And again, that was Stacy. You can reach her at stacy@branchescenter.com. That's S-T-A-C-Y at branchescenter.com. And you can go to her website, which is branchescenter.com. Really an expert in the field of compassion, resiliency, shame resiliency, and Brene Brown's work. Really appreciated her time tonight. Really appreciate your time. So, hey, we'll catch up with you again next week, same place, same time. And as I say at the end of every show, there's only going to be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll catch up with you next week. And do have a great one. Talk to you later.